This is tape 4 of the interview with Bill Hamilton, taking place on the 7th of February 1994. I'm Stephen Foster. Bill, can you tell us a little bit about Joe Burton and his contribution perhaps to the university generally?
Yes. Well, Joe and Barbara Burton were very substantial people, people of great quality. And Joe was a person, in my memory, much admired, much respected and admired, and I was tempted to say loved, and I will, by his staff, academic and non-academic. I don't know what part he played in the moves before incorporation in 1960, but he certainly resented the incorporation. He worked well at ensuring that it be achieved, but I think, perhaps I think subjectively, with a certain degree of resentment and a certain crankiness in some affairs. That may have been like me through increasing age, but he played his part nobly and effectively, but I think perhaps unforgivingly.
Unforgiving of the attitude that people in the Institute took towards the school?
Unforgiving of the incorporation. He would have been, one can see he would have been better placed as the Vice-Chancellor of a separate university than as, I was going to say, a slightly sidelined functionary of the hybrid institution. That'll be a bit unkind, I suppose, because he did have his part as principal of the School of General Studies within the university. But it was not the same for him, I'm sure, as being head of an independent organisation.
How did he get on with Huxley and Crawford? Crawford in his capacity as fiscal advisor, I mean.
Yes. I think well. I don't remember any expressed difficulties.
And within the School of General Studies, was it clear that he was principal, in fact, as well as by status? Did Manning Clark, Alec Hope, Heinz Arndt and so on defer to him as they would to a principal?
I would never dare to guess what was in the mind of that distinguished trio. And the answer to your question, leaving aside those three, is I don't know. I think so. I think he had a very clear, what's the fashionable word these days, uncontested leadership status as the head of the School of General Studies.
And yet his publications were fairly slight.
Yes, yes. I think he was a head of an institution rather than a preeminent academic. But then that's making judgments that are beyond my skills.
We might come back and talk later in general terms about leadership qualities. But, we might not too, but... let's move on to Crawford and his becoming becoming Vice-Chancellor. And at that stage, of course, there were two contenders, Crawford and Enor. Can you remember the ins and outs of that appointment?
No, in fact, I'm surprised to know that Enor was considered a candidate. He may well be right. He may well be right. But I was not registrar at that stage and therefore not a secretary of the university council running the affair. And I'm surprised to know what you've just told me, not only because I didn't know it before, but also because I would have thought there was no contest. And especially no contest in Enor's position within the Institute, standing within the Institute.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, my belief is, and again I'm making judgments on academic capacity, Enor didn't have a high standing as a medical investigator. He was given the head of the school, the John Curtin School, because most people wanted to get on with their academic work and were not interested in the tedious detail of administration, whereas Hugh was willing to take it on. He, I think, not unkindly, wanted or enjoyed the status that went with being head of school. But I think he had no high standing as a research academic, and that view would have been held more or less throughout the whole of the Institute. So I would be surprised to know that he was a real contender for the vice-chancellorship.
He clearly then had his supporters on council.
Did he? Oh. Well, they may have been non-university people. Yes.
I think so, but yeah. I'd have to look again at
was,
the minutes.
Now I'm going to question you. Was his potential appointment discussed on council?
Yes. Yes, in some detail. Mm. And if my memory serves me right, Flory administered the coup de grace.
Oh. Well, that's all good fun, as I don't recall that or didn't know of it. But if it was in the council documents in any degree, I should have known of it.
There was, in fact, a move on the part of academic staff to keep him out.
Well, that would not surprise me, though I didn't know of it. Mm. But you see, that's an interesting development, because here we have the move by academics to keep out another academic from the head post. The opposite to the objection to the first two vice-chancellors as being administrators and bookkeepers rather than academics. Mm-hmm. Because Crawford's status at that time surely must have been that of a very competent bureaucrat and highly regarded international, what shall I call him? I don't know, bureaucrat again, I guess. Mm. What was the date? 1968 or so? Mm.
67.
67, yes.
Well, I beg your pardon, it might be early 68. I'm not quite sure, because Huxley was there for in excess of 7 years, and he took office in September 1960. I think it might well have been the very beginning of 68, however.
And I guess Enor was Deputy Vice-Chancellor then?
Yes.
Yes. I suppose that gave him a kind of, a status which required consideration as the Vice-Chancellor.
Well, he was peeved when he didn't get it anyhow, and that, of course, hastened his departure to the department.
Yes. Oh, well, that's interesting.
Let's move on to Crawford. Let's move on to Crawford.
Yes.
He rates very highly in university folklore, I guess, as a very competent vice-chancellor.
Yes.
But did he, as vice-chancellor, display the same diversity of interests that he did as fiscal advisor?
You mean outside interests or
interests
within the university? Yes, that was Jack's besetting sin, of course. He was a workaholic, and he knew that he was competent, and I don't mean that at all unkindly, he clearly was. Consequently, he was asked to do all kinds of tasks outside the university, and he could never refuse. And so we didn't see enough of him. Now, he undertook an outside, quite lengthy inquiry for the Menzies government. I've forgotten the subject. But his other activities, of course, related to the World Bank and United Nations, and he was abroad a very great deal. Now, I would say that even if the university got only 10% of Jack's concentration, they still got a remarkably able vice-chancellor. But he, in my view, did not give enough time, and certainly he was very hard for us to get into a corner and pin down on some matters. I saw him frequently, by that I mean maybe 3 times a week, at that stage on budgetary matters, and he was out of the university so much that I mostly saw him only very late in the afternoon, 5:30 or so, and that was all right, and he was never at a loss, but he was tired, and he wasn't really at his best in dealing with those matters, even though he never really fudged them.
Do you think the academics had the same experience?
Yes, very much so.
Did they give evidence of that? Did they express unease that they were unable to gain access to the Vice-Chancellor?
No, I wouldn't put it that way. They expressed, and I'm speaking very generally, they expressed unease that the major part of his interests were not concentrated on the university.
Expressing that unease individually, or
yes, I don't remember any corporate or organised or sizeable. It was just mutterings.
When he arrived, he initiated an administrative shake-up. Why did he do that, and what form did it take?
I think the key to that stems from what I've just said, his frequency of absence obliged him to have a full-time deputy vice-chancellor. Hitherto we had acting vice-chancellors in the way of Enor and Trendle and other, and Burton and others, I guess. But with him away so much, and knowing to himself that he would be away a good deal, and in fairness to him, let's say, my memory is that the council also knew, and from his expression, that he would want to be free to take on other tasks. But because of those potential absences, he needed a full-time deputy vice-chancellor. And that was the principal post created in that administrative reshuffle. But what else happened? I can't remember. Can you?
Well, one thing was the new post of secretary. And Ross Holden, of course, was, his title was changed, but also his functions.
Yes, that's true. I'd forgotten that it came at that time. And his functions, again, were essentially that of a vice-chancellorial type, weren't they?
Well, I wonder. I wonder if the change from the change of position and the change of title didn't hint at a desire on Crawford's part to make administrators more executive and to ensure that policy remained with the Vice-Chancellor and senior academics.
You think about these things at a level that I don't contemplate. Oh, that's possible. But I don't remember that. I suppose I'm being mentally lazy because David Hodgkin and I went on doing the kinds of things we'd done a long time. And I suppose that for that reason I wasn't much affected by Ross's new role, except that I did report to him rather than directly to the Vice-Chancellor.
And you noticed no difference in Ross's new role?
Yes, I suppose I must have done. I was happy to report to him, but with access to the Vice-Chancellor, rather than directly to the Vice-Chancellor, because he was there more. I wasn't left on a day-to-day wondering when I could get through to the chief.
Just moving back to Huxley's period, where you didn't have that one dominant force there, or that very clear decision maker, or yes, certain decision maker. Did Ross Honan then play a significant policy-making role?
I think so. I'm always nervous of the word policy, but certainly it was always an executive role of the highest order. Perhaps even that during Huxley's time, with Len Huxley's perhaps limited area of interest, Ross was already playing a very senior policy-making and administrative controlling role.
That term secretary is a rather odd one, isn't it? Do you have any idea where that came from?
They were to use another term, and he wanted another term. I think he wanted assistant vice-chancellor, and that was opposed by many academics on the basis that he was not an academic, and that the vice-chancellorial role in its sundry gradations should always have an academic background. It later, of course, changed, as you know. But where the name came from, I don't know. I suspect it's an English term, is it? We tended to go to English universities for formal titles. I've forgotten where it came from.
At this stage too, Colin Plowman is starting to play a more significant role in administration. No?
Colin was with us a long time and then went away to the University of New South Wales, remember? And he didn't come back until Tony Lowe's time.
Aha, so he's out of it at that particular stage.
I don't associate him in my mind with working with Crawford at all, except perhaps in his pre-University of New South Wales days, when he would have been a kind of academic registrar. Whether we call him that or not, I don't know.
Did you have any impression of who Crawford looked to as his chief advisors?
I'd like preliminary notice of that kind of question. I would think it was the secretary, certainly in administrative matters, but in academic matters it would not be Ross, other than a kind of minor way. In academic matters I think he worked very well, that's to say very closely, with the two chairmen of the boards. And they changed, of course, somewhat in his time, I guess, but I believe that he was very, not rigid, but very meticulous in working in that way. But I guess that certainly in terms of administration and in terms of relationships with the University's Commission and government bureaucracies, it would have been to Ross. Except we must keep in mind, of course, that Crawford had very strong links with the Commonwealth bureaucracy at all kinds of levels. And so he didn't need any intervention or advice in that area.
Was he able to go straight to, the then Prime Minister, whoever it might have been?
Yes, I think so. 1968, who was Prime Minister? Menzies had gone. It would have been Holt or Gorton.
Gorton just Gorton then.
Yes. I don't recall they had any particular role in relation to the university. But he would certainly have had ready access if he needed it.
Who were you dealing with mostly amongst the academics? Were you going straight to the heads of schools? Did you have frequent meetings with the heads of schools and the deans of faculties?
Yes. I recall that my principal meetings of importance were via the heads of schools, the budget advisors mechanism, which was both heads of schools and the deans in the School of General Studies, with, of course, meetings of the heads of schools. But we quite freely rang each other, mostly at the heads of schools level, or deans. I would have had transactions, of course, with heads of departments, particularly heads of departments who may have had budgetary concerns in the purchase of equipment, for example. So there was a fairly free interchange at several levels, but the important things, the budgetary things, were largely through the budget advisors.
Can you tell us a bit about that budget advisors committee?
They were, as you know, the heads of school, the vice chancellor, of course, the heads of school, the fiscal advisor when we had one. The heads of schools and the deans of the faculties, plus the registrar, as he then was, and the bursar, me. The budgets were formed initially in the sense of being drawn up within the schools and the faculties by their own academic committees, but brought together by people we called business managers, or sometimes laboratory managers, senior non-academic staff. They then sent the estimates to me, and I looked through them for any unusual developments, and consolidated them, and they went to the Vice-Chancellor and to his budget advisors. And they were chewed around there in terms of new developments, sudden growths in old developments, establishments, and what are either known funds for the ensuing year would be, or what we guessed they might be. Because there was a period of both. I suppose the interesting thing about the worth or otherwise the budget advisors arrangement was that it endured for a long time. It may exist even now, I'm not sure. I don't know.
Who initiated it?
I don't know.
Because there was a committee of council, I guess.
The finance committee.
And that too endured, did it not?
Yes, it didn't spend as much detailed time on the estimates as the budget advisors did, not by any means. They gave things a pretty good thoroughgoing over, and any battles between contending parties for slices of the cake were fought out in that group. I don't know how it started, except that it was a pretty obvious way of proceeding. If you had to discuss the budgets internally, well, then you discuss them through the directors and deans, and I suppose it was only later that they came to be called the budget advisors. I could be wrong, it occurs to me. Maybe they were associated with the appointment, by Huxley of Crawford as his fiscal advisor. Crawford may have said, no, I don't think that's right. I'm plodding around. I think, as I said a moment ago, it was just a natural development.
Well, we can check that. Did you have a clear impression as bursar of the relative merits of various deans and heads of schools and heads of departments when it came to budgetary matters?
In budgetary matters, oh yes. Some were expert, some could accommodate it readily and shrewdly, and others tended to paddle along, but could be men in seeking what their school needs or what they thought it needed. I don't recall any clear failures, except of course two.
Yes.
You want me to say those? Well, one we already know, and that was Huxley. And the other was Williams.
Vice Chancellor Williams.
Yes, Chancellor Williams.
We'll come back to Williams in a moment.
Yes.
Did you... were there any heads of departments, say, who overspent with the deliberate object of trying you on, as it were, or trying the system on?
No, the business managers kept an eye on that. Heads of departments could raise requisitions, of course, and they could say what they needed, but those requisitions didn't become purchase orders until they'd been cleared in the budget office of the school, not in the central office, of the school, by the business manager. And a similar procedure applied in staffing. Certainly non-academic staff, the appointments had to be fitted within the establishment and cleared by the business manager, and in the case of academic staff, they had to be cleared by the school committee and the board of the institute or of the school. Mm. So heads of departments didn't have a free go. They had a free go in terms of shuffling around what they felt their needs were, but they were not free to exceed their overall sums. And I don't recall any occasion, unless it were very early, that could have occurred.
Was there any correlation between financial competence and field of study?
Between financial competence and...
field of study.
No, I wouldn't think so. You mean, were economists the best budget advisors? I don't remember, and I don't think so, no.